I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Come and show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Ruttles Film Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Prefab 4 fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about starring or inspired by the Ruttles. This week, that film is The Ruttles, All You Need Is Cash, a 1978 made-for-TV documentary following the career of Dirk, Nasty, Stig and Barry, who created a musical legend that lasted at lunchtime. And that's probably about as far as I can take that joke. Ed, obviously The Ruttles is a parody of The Beatles, so my first obvious question to you is, this parody of The Beatles, how well does it parody The Beatles?
It parodies The Beatles very effectively. But it depends on how you think about parodies. I suppose that it's fair to say that the way that we parody things has moved on since 1978. And while I think The Ruttles is very, very successful in taking elements of the Beatles' career and showing you alternative versions of them that are sort of satisfactorily accurate, it does not always succeed in making effective jokes out of that.
Okay, give me an example.
Okay, the Ed Sullivan Show.
So yeah, that's a really good one.
So the way they do the Ed Sullivan Show is as follows. They show you the familiar footage, Ed Sullivan talking to camera, the bit we all know, now all these young boys come over from Liverpool, all that stuff, which is, that's my first ever Ed Sullivan impression.
You know what, it's pretty solid.
I'm
for
quite
a first
pleased
attempt.
With that, yeah, actually. Yeah. No, that's not bad. Anyway, so I'm not going to try it again, because I'll just ruin it.
Yeah.
But anyway, so he's doing his thing to camera, and he says, you know, these boys from Liverpool. And then when he says Beatles, there's a fairly brutal edit in which, like, someone voices over Ruttles, and it's like, it's brutal.
They should have got you to do the voiceover.
They definitely should have done. Yeah, yeah. Although I was minus 1 year old at the time, unfortunately.
Wouldn't have stopped a pro like you.
So, so somebody voices it over, and it's a fairly brutal edit. And like, part of the joke is that it's a fairly brutal edit, and you can hear it.
Mm.
But then what happens is he introduces the Ruttles, who play a Beatles-like song, which I think is maybe "Hold Your Hand" or or "Number One." I forget which one it is. And then that is that. And what you've really got there is a recreation of the same thing, with the Ruttles there instead of the Beatles. What it's not doing is making any kind of joke out of that. Mm. And I think that parody needs to make a commentary on the thing it's parodying. It may have been enough at the time, and I can see why it would have been very satisfying to watch at the time, but I don't think it's quite enough to just do the thing that the original thing did.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I see. I mean, I think we, you know, we have, I'd like to say deliberately, got straight into the meat of this discussion, which is that a parody, like you say, in of itself, should actually be doing something with that subject matter other than just recreating it faithfully.
Yeah.
And I think maybe it's worth saving the discussion on the actual music, the album of songs that was sort of released in conjunction with this film, and concentrating just on the Beatles as they're presented in this film first, because I think it's probably worth having a discussion about those two things separately.
Sure.
So I think I often have trouble when I'm reviewing films being funny about a film that is already a comedy.
Yes, very true.
Because it's there already, you know, there's only so much you can go with that genre. And I think it's very easy to be comical about a film that is taking itself seriously.
Yeah.
As opposed to a film that's a comedy. In the same way, the Beatles were funny people.
Mm,
they were already funny characters.
Yeah.
Already. So, you know, there were a couple of like really obvious moments in the film where I'm just like, well, that's just what happened.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Like just doing it again. The news conference when they're answering questions and they're being a bit funny about it. Mm. You know, like, did seeing the Queen make you feel better? No, seeing my doctor makes you feel better. Yeah, not my doctor. Well, no, not your doctor.
Right.
Like, all that kind of stuff. Like that's just the kind of like back and forth that they actually had.
Yeah.
And when you see them like goofing around on during the musical section of Ouch, which is obviously a parody of Help.
Yeah.
It's literally what they were doing in the film. Like they were just goofing around with whatever they had to hand. So it's hard to sort of see what comedy value the film is delivering when it is just basically recreating what the Beatles were doing in the first place.
Yeah, it's I know what you mean. And also it's, there's so much affection for the Ruttles, you know, among Beatles fans, among the Beatles themselves, other than Paul, who was not all that keen to begin with, although I think he's turned the corner now. So generally speaking, like all the Beatles liked it, or at least came to like it. And I feel like, I don't know, we're not here to slay a sacred cow. You know, this is not the aim of this. And I, and by the way, I really enjoy it. It's good fun to watch. I think it's probably the third or fourth time I've seen it. I enjoy it every time, but if I'm perfectly honest, every time I kind of think to myself, oh, is that all?
Yeah.
Oh, I feel really bad saying it because because like I do genuinely have a lot of affection for it, but there is a lot of me that just thinks, and maybe it's because of over familiarity with the subject matter that it's parodying, you know, because there are some quite specific bits of news footage that it's parodying that I know very well, and so a lot of me just thinks, oh, you're just doing that again.
Yeah, like, but I don't know, because I feel like the bits of news footage that they're parodying only works because you know that subject matter in the first place. You know, you couldn't show someone of a younger generation who isn't necessarily as well versed in the Beatles' career as we are now. I believe that these people exist.
Yeah.
And you can show them the Ruttles and expect them to understand the thing that the film is trying to do.
Mm.
It requires that pre-knowledge to get the joke. But the point is that there isn't always a joke.
Yeah. That's a really good way of putting it, because actually it's that thing of an observational comedian. You know, it's someone like an observational stand-up comic, you know, you sort of like Michael McIntyre or someone like that, who's, you know, not particularly my cup of tea, but he's a really, really skilled observational comic.
Mm.
And he will be on stage and he will say things like, do you know that thing when you're like trying to toast some bread and you know, and you've only got the toaster on, you know, level 2 and it burns the toast, and you think, well, why, you know, why is the, what's level 8 then in that case? You know, I haven't made
this to be fair. I was going to make fun, but actually, you know what, as an off the cuff example of what the kind of thing that an observational comedian might say,
right,
that's fairly solid, I think.
It's a bit
90s Seinfeld, yeah, but I'll give you it.
I think, to be perfectly honest, I think I may have seen Stuart Lee say something similar when parodying Michael McIntyre. So
oh,
I think
God, there were so many, there's so many layers to it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, God, in a podcast where we're talking about a parody, you've invoked an example from a comedian that was actually using that example whilst parodying something.
Yeah, which isn't even parodying the thing we're talking about.
No.
It's something entirely different. It's an example. Oh, God.
Oh,
right.
Oh, God, this is Inception.
So anyway, so to come back up from the snow level in Inception... I think there's a thing when an observational comedian says, you know that thing, right, where this thing happens, and everyone goes, ha, yes, you're absolutely right. That thing does happen to me. And that is satisfying because it's like someone has said, no, this thing happens as well. And like, you know, and, you know, in a slightly deeper way, maybe it makes you feel slightly less alone because other people go through the same thing as you. Who knows? But essentially, that's what's happening. You're just being, someone is saying, this thing happens to me as well. Isn't it funny that these things happen to all of us? But they're not necessarily making a joke about that. There is an extra layer of it where you actually make a joke about the thing, as opposed to there is satisfaction in the recognition of someone saying, yes, this thing happens to all of us. That's satisfying in and of itself, but it's not a joke.
Yes, I agree with you.
We've gone so deep on this already.
Yes, we really, really have. Yeah. It's a really interesting point you're making because we're kind of deconstructing observational comedy.
Yes.
As a way to critique this spoof movie.
Yeah. The Beatles are a good band.
They were quite good. Yeah, yeah. But not as good as this point you're making now about observational comedy. Let me think about this.
Yep.
So I think that it differs slightly because what you're saying there is an observational comic would make a point that is funny because it is universally recognized but isn't spoken of. Whereas this is spoofing a film that is hopefully recognizable to everybody because it's in the mainstream.
Yes, almost. Other than when you said it's spoof... We're so close to it. We're so close to beginning the podcast.
By all means, let's spend an hour on this.
Almost.
Okay.
But when you say it's spoofing a film, that is a key point.
Okay.
Because it's not spoofing a film.
Okay.
Because the film that we are thinking of it spoofing, i.e. the Beatles anthology, is not going to be made.
Sorry,
for
I misspoke. What I meant was it's spoofing footage, spoofing like a career. It's spoofing a thing that is already in the mainstream, basically, right? I think that's the thing. Like, so a really good example would be when, it's one of the highlights in the film that I'm sure that everyone who loves this film would agree is when they talk about the Beatles. Sorry, excuse me, the Russells' discovery and subsequent problems with tea. That's a funny thing because that is, here is a thing that we know, we all know what that actually refers to, but it's been given sort of a parody twist.
Yes, exactly,
right? That makes sense to me,
and that's the point of parody.
Yes, exactly. Whereas the Ed Sullivan example you gave earlier where they perform a song, a perfectly serviceable Beatles sounding song, isn't by any means, I wouldn't say, funny.
No, there isn't a joke in it. I mean, I enjoy watching it.
Yeah,
like it's fun to watch, but there isn't a joke in it.
Yeah, I don't know where that lands us on the toast thing. I think maybe we should drop the toast thing. But I think we agree on this point that there needs to be a point of the parody or a commentary on the thing itself that then serves as the parody.
Yeah, okay.
Right, so...
So stick with tea, not toast.
Yes, okay. Let's stick with tea.
Okay, fine.
God. If we move on to the songs, and I think this probably brings this into sharper focus, right? Because, by the way, I should point out, this is the first time I've watched this film.
Yep.
And I've been really looking forward to it because I know how much it is held in very high regard by Beatles fans. So I've been really looking forward to watching the film. I did sneak several listens of the album before attempting watching the film.
Mm.
Under the impression that the album itself might stand up on its own right as a parody album of a Beatles album. And listening to that several times, I just felt like, oh, these are just songs that sound like the Beatles. There's not actually a joke in any of them. They're just Beatlesy songs.
Yes.
So I was under the impression that maybe they just make better sense in context. I don't think they do. I think the songs are more often than not just very, very good recreations of Beatles sounding songs.
I mean, actually, just listening to the songs on Spotify or whatever, as we have been the last couple of days, for me, that's the bit that really does work as a parody. Because I feel like if I listen to one of the Ruttles songs and it is a really effective pastiche of a Beatles song, that in itself is satisfying and it's enough.
Yes.
Because I can listen to it and think, brilliant, isn't that clever? And the song itself is good. I mean, some of them are kind of, what's the Living in Hope?
Yes.
It's arguably a better song than Don't Pass Me By, to be perfectly honest.
But I think, we're going to get into host territory again. I think that I agree with you in that the experience of listening to the album is very satisfying because of the painstaking detail they have gone to recreate that sound.
Yeah.
However, I don't think that necessarily means that they are good parodies.
Mm-hmm.
What they haven't done in those songs is find a way to take a Beatles song and turn the content of that song on its head in a way that turns it into a joke.
Yeah.
What they've done instead is, it's a little bit similar to, and I don't mean this to be a disservice, because I do think it's an incredible accomplishment that as I understand it, mostly Neil Innes has achieved in writing and recreating his songs. But it's a little bit like if you fed a bot the entire Beatles back catalogue,
yeah,
and asked for it to come up with a Beatles song,
yeah,
or an album of Beatles songs.
Yeah.
That's the overall impression, the overall result I get.
Yeah, but I think, I mean, when you listen to the songs on their own, they don't particularly need to have jokes within them.
Nope.
The fact that,
I agree.
Although there are some that do. Like you pointed out to me earlier when we were listening to the Archaeology album, the With a Little Help from My Friends parody?
Rendezvous,
yeah.
Yeah.
Has a joke in it, which I hadn't noticed the first time until you pointed it out and then we listened to it again, whereby, because it's a call and response, lead vocal and backing vocalists thing, but it introduces a concept whereby the lead vocalist is having an argument with the backing vocalists. That is great. You know, yeah. And that thing is a completely self-contained joke. It doesn't need, yep, to live within a film. But I think in general, it is enough for the songs themselves to be effective, pleasing pastiches, and then for the actual jokes to come when they're used in the film, for them to prop up the jokes in the film. However, as we've said, that there aren't quite enough jokes in the film to achieve that.
But I should point out as well that the example you've given there is from a later album.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah,
and I don't think that, you know, my biggest, I guess, point to make about the Archaeology album, which I hadn't, again, I've only listened to as preparation for this recording, is that feels like a much more successful parody. Like the songs on that album and the substance of the lyrics and the approach to those are much more in keeping of what we understand to be a parody than the original Ruttles album.
Yeah.
The original Ruttles albums is mostly, barring a few sort of pun titles and the odd lyric here or there, are mostly just very good Beatles replicas.
Yeah.
Can I talk about what I think does work as a parody in this film?
Sure. I mean, it's about time.
Toast. No, I'm joking. I think that for me, the best moments in this film, the funniest moments in this film, are watching Eric Idle as the narrator.
Yeah.
Like, he has by far the best quotes, the best one-liners. Like, this idea, this brilliant, brilliant idea of how he seems at battle with the camera he's presenting to.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
it's,
yeah,
just really clever, yeah, really well done.
Yeah.
And it actually made me think, oh, this feels like a precursor to like the Day to Day, which I grew up on. Like, you know,
yeah,
this sort of like Chris Morris view on how best to satirize media.
Yeah.
And, you know, like when he's talking about, like, they met at this very spot and the camera, like, pans past it, so he has to keep up with the camera, and he's, like, back there, like, a few feet back there, like, yeah, you know, yeah, that's where they met. I think it's generally brilliant, and it happens quite a lot. Yeah. And it makes me think that the film might be better viewed as a satire on the media coverage of the Beatles than it is as a parody of the Beatles themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there are a few other elements. I think that, you know, the tabloids around the Beatles coming out to enjoying tea, that's a very strong, you know, that being able to show this is how news reportage of the Beatles enjoying tea would be shown as tabloid headlines. I think that's brilliantly done. And also when it gets to the point later on where Ron Nasty's new girlfriend, who's clearly a Yoko surrogate in the film, is the literal daughter of Hitler. is like that's I don't feel like the film at that point definitely isn't making a joke about Yoko Ono.
No.
They're making a joke about how she was received by media at the time.
Yeah, and they're sitting in a hotel shower with turned on rather than having a bed in. Yeah, those are the things. I remember those things, like thinking specifically, like this is parodying this whole. This is parodying the bed in and all the media coverage to John and Yoko around that time, really well, really effectively. And yeah, you're right. Those Eric Idle bits where he's, you know, presenting the story. Because he sort of he'd done that before, and I think like Python more broadly had done that before. So I can think of the bit where in the And Now for Something Completely Different film, when he is introducing the sort of the hell, what goes on to be like the Hell's Grannies segment.
Right, yeah,
And he is walking down the pavement, and the camera is backing away from him. Yeah. And he's talking to get, and then he falls down a manhole. And it's the same thing. It's like, it's, you know, he's like, he's being very, very serious. And then it's parodying the idea in a way that the presenter actually needs to be outside the place where the thing happens.
Yes, exactly, like, that. Yeah.
Here I am standing outside the hotel where this, well, not in the exact spot, yeah, but yeah, here, yeah, on, yeah, you know.
And here I am in a limousine in New York, right, and this is where, you know, not here, obviously, in the limousine, but in New York. Yeah, all of that stuff. I know it's brilliant, but you're exactly right. That's it. It is a very effective parody of the format.
Yes.
In a way that I'm hard-pressed to think of an earlier example of when that had been done.
Yeah, because that sort of mockumentary thing, because like when you talked about the day-to-day, you know, I remember the day-to-day, and like that had that sort of faux documentary thing in it, that sort of prefigured The Office. You know, there was that,
people
working at the swimming pool, and there was one that was, I think, even called The Office in the day-to-day, that prefigured that. But yeah, this thing of taking the piss a bit out of the way documentaries are made.
Yes.
And poking fun at how documentaries
are made. And you made the point earlier about this is, you know, the form that documentaries take follow a template. You know, this idea that the journalist always has to be outside the hotel before he's saying, this is the hotel where they're actually staying at, like that kind of thing. Like, it doesn't have to happen in a documentary.
No.
And this film very successfully pokes fun at that.
Yeah.
And like I say, this is constant battle between the narrator and the camera itself. Like, not necessarily, you get the impression it's not a camera person, but just the camera itself, the thing that he's presenting to, like,
yes,
getting away from him or move, like doing a thing that he doesn't want it to do at that time while he's trying to be very serious.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was very, very clever. For me, the funnier moments in the film, the bits that work best in the film are Eric Idle in that role, spoofing the idea of documentaries and the documentary template,
yeah,
more than the actual elements that are supposed to be parody of the Beatles' career.
Yeah, yeah. And I wonder whether, because he's obviously spoofing the documentary, but I suppose he's also spoofing the rockumentary, if you will. But then in 1978, I don't know, were we familiar with the rock documentary?
Yeah,
and
it's difficult to know that, isn't it?
Well, this is the interesting thing, because you and I are very familiar with the Beatles anthology, and so we can watch it and think, as I said earlier, like, you know, it is almost as if it is parodying something that then happened, what, 17 years later? Yes. 16, 17 years later.
And yeah, it's because it's a really interesting point, isn't it? So we know that as preparation for this film, Eric Idle was given access to what was then Neil Aspinall's Long and Winding Road documentary. So the footage that he had been compiling for a documentary about the Beatles' career that would eventually, over a decade later, become the anthology. Yeah. But at that time was basically a private project where he was compiling footage and news reports and all the usual information and stuff in order to be able to one day release a documentary about the Beatles.
Yeah.
Eric Idle was given this footage to help with the Russells.
Yeah.
So he's working on, or he's working from, material that the rest of the world hasn't seen yet.
Mm.
Like, in theory, it's in the public consciousness, but actually the idea of all of these things being strung together, this might actually be the first instance of the Beatles' career being told as one whole story for an audience.
Yeah.
And it happens to be a parody of that story.
Yeah, exactly. Which is kind of perfect in a way.
Yes, yeah.
And certainly, like, George Harrison seems to have felt that way, that, like, this is the best way to do it.
Yeah, you know, yeah, embrace it, you mean.
Yeah, yeah. Embrace it. You know, he says, in I Me Mine, he says something to the, sorry, not the song, the book, I Me Mine. He says something along the lines of, the Russells and the Beatles and the Pythons should have all just got together and formed, like, a comedy music group. You know, yeah. And because he just felt that this film was just the best way to show the Beatles' career, i.e. as the joke that he felt that it was, as the slightly surreal thing that he felt that it was, which you can understand if you'd lived it and you want, and you probably weren't that interested in seeing it reported, you know.
Yeah, like, so yeah.
Seeing it parodied would be much more satisfying, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I totally get that as well. Yeah. There's a story I think Eric Idle tells where there was an encounter he had where George Harrison and Ringo Starr sang Ouch, the parody of Help, to him and Neil Innes. And it was like, this idea of two Beatles singing a Russells song to the Russells.
Yeah.
Like, just incredible. But yeah, you do get the impression, and from what we know about George Harrison's relationship and support for the Monty Python troupe, you just get this idea that this was perfectly in keeping with his sense of humour and how he would want to have this career explored for audiences.
Yeah.
To the extent that obviously he cameos in the film.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, so he's there as a news reporter, he's interviewing Michael Palin, who is playing a character called Eric Manchester, who's the Derek Taylor version. Michael Palin, by the way, doing a sort of excellent Derek Taylor. You know, in a way that I always find it really satisfying when someone is, you're not doing an impersonation of, but sort of parodying someone and putting more effort into it than you needed to, particularly. Because let's face it, even now, not that many people are familiar with how Derek Taylor looked and sounded. Mm. And in 1978, even fewer. But he's really, he's sort of mustachioed and louche and all the rest of it, you know, and it's just really
a great word.
It's really nice how much Derek Taylor he's giving in the whole thing. And it's great, you know.
And that is a very funny scene as well.
Yes.
Like with everyone sort of robbing the indoor, the offices. But also it's a really interesting point to land on, because one of the things that I found surprising about the film, given that George Harrison was an advocate for it, as far as we've been told through different accounts, John Lennon was a big fan, Ringo Starr was more or less a big fan, Paul McCartney less so, but later on, thanks to Linda, you know, turning around on it, I was surprised that the film dealt with some of the more tragic moments in the Beatles' career in the way that it did.
Yeah.
In particular, Leppo.
Yes.
Who is obviously, you know, I mean, we've just come off the back of recently watching an early episode, The Birth of the Beatles. Obviously, in the previous season of this podcast, we covered Backbeat. You know, having watched at least one of those films that deals with Stu Sutcliffe's death in a very sort of big, impactful way for the Beatles, it feels very strange that this then becomes an object of comedy in the film.
Yeah.
I think he disappears with the rats and is never seen again is the story there.
So, I mean, there is a good joke in it where the fact that he's called Leppo is because he's like another Marx brother. So which is it? Harpo Marx is the Marx brother so there's a good joke in that. But also the interesting thing in that is in 1978, how many people were aware of Stuart Sutcliffe?
Yeah,
how exactly. many people yeah, were even right. aware that they'd been to Hamburg, particularly? I mean, do you know what I mean? They might have spoken about it a little bit in interviews, but I'm not sure there had particularly been.
We don't really know, though, do we? I think that's the. I guess that's the point.
Well, I think maybe if I had a better handle on what date various books came out, but then even if a pretty popular book had come out by that point. Which sort of dealt with the whole crit. So, like Hunter Davis's book had come out because that came out in 68 or 69 or whatever it was. So that would have told people that. But still, for people to get some of the jokes in this or even have an idea what is being parodied, they would need to have a fairly in-depth knowledge of Beatle history.
Yeah.
And, and there are other things in that, as you say, how some of the sort of real life tragedies are dealt with. So the death of Brian Epstein is dealt with where the equivalent character, Leggy Mountbatten,
still gets a laugh. I mean,
it's a good joke. Yeah. It's a good joke. And you know that guy is in Life of Brian as well.
Oh, is he?
He's in the Blessed Are the Cheesemakers scene right at the start. He and his wife are sort of arguing with... they wanted to shut up, the thing at the start.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's him.
Yeah, so the Leggy Mountbatten character accepts a teaching post in Australia, but it's kind of set up like he's going to die. And then they do the whole, they're shocked and stunned, And then, and actually, that was one where I kind of felt it aligning with real life in that, because that footage, that footage where in real life, where the guy's saying to John Lennon, what plans have you made? And he is absolutely dumbstruck.
Yeah.
And he's just, we haven't made any. We've only just heard. And you can see on his face that how absolutely, he just has no idea how, he literally just heard the news that his friend is dead.
Yeah, yeah.
Minutes earlier.
And that is something that I realised that a short space of time feels so much longer when it comes to the Beatles' career.
Right.
So, 1978 is, 9 years after the Beatles' last album.
Yep.
Right. And that probably feels like a very, very long time. But I guess it's hard for us to grasp how fresh still some of this stuff would have been.
Yeah.
What are we talking realistically? Maybe 15 years? I can't do the maths. 15 years before... Brian Epstein's death would have been roughly 15 years before this film came out, right?
11.
You're going to do the maths. Is it? No, that's not right, is it?
67 he died in. So 67, 78.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so 11 years. It makes my point even more powerful.
quite right.
Yeah. So 11 years.
Yep.
So Brian Epstein would have died 11 years beforehand. Do we think that it still felt fresh at that point, considering all we know that the band and him would have gone through at that time?
Mm.
It's an interesting thing to think that 11 years later, it was okay to make a joke about their reaction to their friend's death.
Yeah.
That feels quite difficult to swallow, I think.
Yeah, and I think... To Eric Idle says on the DVD commentary, which I was listening to yesterday, that 2 years later, when John Lennon died in real life, I think George Harrison, when asked for his reaction, said he was shocked and stunned.
Right.
Yeah. I think. And I'm not sure whether that's completely true, but but I can imagine it's the case. And but also it's not so much that George would have been making a joke at that time, but it's also just the eliding of reality and fiction, because actually that is a scene where I struggle to before sort of rewatching this, I sort of struggle to remember in my head whether they actually real life in Bangor used the words shocked and stunned.
Going back to where the film works though, is that there are funny jokes made in and around those situations. I feel like they're dealing with tricky subject matters to be parodying at that point. But, you know, again, for me, it's all about the narrator. So when he's, you know, he's at the rat cellar and he's saying, you know, regardless of what he says about Leppo, but that is surrounded by loads of stuff that is genuinely really funny. Where he's talking about, like, you know, the bed and the breakfast. The bed is still here. The breakfast long gone, rodently chewed, mouse masticated.
Yeah.
In a word, eaten by rats.
Yeah.
And then, the you know, the fact that Leggy Mountbatten took up a teaching post in Australia. That is genuinely, that's those are really funny jokes.
Yeah.
It's when it switches to the Beatles part of it that I feel like this is
it's just the
portrayal of those moments. I don't necessarily feel like they're bringing the jokes into that. It's just, you're just recreating what happened.
There are also bits where you think, well, what is this parodying? So you can kind of see why Paul wasn't all that keen on Eric Idle's portrayal of him. When so there's the scene where Dirk McQuickley marries Bianca Jagger. Well, it's not Bianca Jagger, played by Bianca Jagger, who marries a French actress, I think's the idea. And so you
speaks see, not very good English and not a word of French.
Right, yeah, which, and that's a good joke. But and so you see, like, the wedding day stuff. And actually, the interesting thing about that is that Eric Idle's hair in that is exactly the same as Paul's hair was on his wedding day in 1968.
Right.
Sorry, 69. 69, when Paul and Linda got married. And his hair is exactly the same. Like, it's quite sort of floppy. And, you know, he's sort of, I think it looks like recently clean shaven.
Right.
So you think this is obviously parodying Paul and Linda's wedding day.
Yeah.
And then what it is A, like a French actress, which is, I don't know what that's trying to parody. And then beyond that, the joke is that his new wife is like quite bored by him and seems to be rolling her eyes a lot. And he's like trying to kiss her and she keeps moving out the way and things like that. Which is like sort of quite good slapstick and is like quite funny and stuff. Bianca Jagger is really funny. The sort of non-verbal acting she's doing is really funny. But it's not parodying anything particularly. And I can kind of see why Paul would have watched that and thought, but you're just making me look like an idiot.
Yeah.
Like,
you know. Because there is something to be said about each of the Beatles' portrayal with their respective rattle.
Yeah.
So I think that Ron Nasty as Lennon is actually very, very faithful to the real Lennon and his sort of journey.
And brilliantly played by Neil Innes as well. Really good. It's a fantastic performance by Neil Innes.
I think that Stig, that's just kind of like it's a little bit of a, well, it's not a one note joke, is it? It's the idea of George's interest in spiritualism, I guess, informed the casting of that role.
Yes, and also the idea that he was the quiet one and the character doesn't say a word in the entire film.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Which that in itself is a good joke.
That's a good joke as well, as is the Maharishi.
Yeah. The Surrey Mystic.
The Surrey Mystic, exactly, yeah. And then Barry Wammer's Ringo.
Yeah.
Which again, I guess there's not an awful lot to his character. There's I think there's one moment in there where it mentions that Barry spent an entire year in bed. And
as a tax dodge.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And other people thought he might be trying to start his own rumour that he'd also died. Like, this is an idea that him trying to compete with the other Beatles would be funny. But yeah, you're right. Like, there's a kind of a broad connection to their respective Beatle.
Yeah.
But the portrayal of Paul doesn't really do Paul justice. Like, he's basically just a bit of a buffoon.
Yeah, which is a shame in a way.
Yeah.
And actually, I wonder how much at the time, the way that Paul was thought. So this is 1978. So what, you're just in like the latter days of Wings when he, so it's probably around sort of Mull of Kintyre time, when actually I wonder whether Paul solo and with Wings is at the peak of people, of him being a bit of a national figure of fun.
Oh, really? Yeah, maybe.
I suppose. I hadn't really thought about it in that context. But yeah, you know, around that time, you know, he's doing the songs of his and Wings that people think of as like the cheesier ones.
Yeah.
Which, you know, with hindsight, are fantastic. But at the time, people thought of as like, oh, this guy is a bit of a lightweight now, you know. So yeah. I suppose maybe 1978 was kind of the peak of that narrative. Well, no, it's sort of post John dying was sort of the peak of that narrative. But but 1978, yes, that idea was still in force. The idea that he was a bit of a lightweight in general.
So maybe that's the point of that portrayal of him.
Yeah. Maybe, yeah. I wasn't really watching it in that context, but it's only now I say it that I come to think of it that way.
The point that you make about Eric Idle's hair in that scene is really important, I think, because one of the most impressive things about the film to me was just the attention to detail in recreating not only footage, but like right down to outfits and props and, you know, when they recreate the most really obvious ones, when they recreate the rooftop performance. And it's like, oh my God, like, I feel like Barry Wong is wearing Maureen's coat. Like it's like the outfits are incredibly familiar.
Yeah.
When there's the performance of Piggy in the Middle from the Tragical History Tour.
Yeah.
That whole song sequence just feels like you're watching an alternate take of I Am the Walrus. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like to the extent that it just wouldn't surprise me that they found the exact spot and recreated it there.
To be honest, that probably would have been the easiest way to do it.
Concrete
thing that the policemen stand on.
Yeah, and the glider goes over.
Right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But like it's just that. Like this for... There's a lot of work that's gone into recreating these scenes really painfully. For Piggy in the Middle, by the way, is actually one of those examples of songs that I think is a very good parody of I Am the Walrus. That is an example of one that I think actually works well, as much as I was sort of downplaying the album's merits earlier. I think that's a good example of one that works well. Yeah. But I just generally, it's not that I'm laughing at it, I'm just impressed by it.
Right, yeah. That's kind of the distinction, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like there are good jokes in that bit as well. The fact that there's like a pantomime cow and like two guys dressed up as a camel in it who are kind of walking around, which is kind of funny in itself, but again, like it's no sillier than what was actually happening in real life.
No, exactly, yeah, you know? That's it.
And because there was a bit of me watching it going, oh, the guy's dressed up as a camel. Yeah, they're really making it look ludicrous. And then you think about what they actually did in real life.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, but that's the thing. It's just it every time you look at a scene and think, this is brilliant, this is a really good parody, you think, well, what is satisfying me about this? Is it the fact that you have pretty faithfully recreated something that the Beatles actually did?
Mm.
Which, and there's a level of satisfaction to that. But what are you, as a comedy film, what are you actually delivering over and above that? So sometimes there are jokes in it over and above that, and sometimes there just aren't. And that's why I feel like it falls a little... I think the main there is a really big, pretty fundamental joke in it that is only sort of half finished. It's only half done. It's this idea that they're called the Ruttles, and the narrator talks about the Rutland sound.
Right.
Now I know this is based on the Rutland Weekend television TV show that Eric Idle did, and I know it comes from there.
We should explain that though, because you know some listeners might not know that. So it started off as a sketch on what was a sketch show.
Yeah.
Called Rutland Weekend Television.
Yes.
Which was, as I understand it, set up as the idea of a local news program.
Yeah.
Rutland was the local area and the sketches were all based around that same theme.
Yes.
So there was this one sketch that started this, the Ruttles basically, was this idea of there being a Beatles-like band that came from the same area.
Yeah.
That then got popularity through Lorne Michaels and Saturday Night Live, and we should probably talk about that part of it as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then hence that then became this sort of spin-off movie.
Yeah, exactly. And Rutland being a real area in the UK that's sort of around Leicestershire, I think, I'm not sure it exists properly anymore because I think boundary changes have actually meant it's been subsumed into other areas of the UK. So I'm not sure it actually exists as a geographical area anymore, but people who live around there might still refer to it as Rutland. So in my mind, the way you do that joke, and I'm about to tell Eric Idle of Monty Python how to write a joke. Listen up, Eric. Here's how it works. No, in my mind, the way you do this is you have this fictional band who come from Rutland and they And so you talk about the Rutland sound, and therefore the entire film is based around this entirely alternative Beatles called the Ruckles, who came from Leicestershire, right?
In the same way that how Brian works in Life of Brian, right? It's an alternative version of what that is parodying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, really good way of thinking about it. Yeah. Like Brian is an alternative Jesus. Ruckles are an alternative Beatles.
Yeah.
You know, bigger than Jesus, arguably. and so that then becomes an entire alternative reality in which you can parody the entire thing, and you can maybe even make the joke that these two things were going on at the same time, or you don't have to if you don't want to. But it leaves open that possibility. But what this does is say, this band is called the Ruckles. The narrator, Eric Idle, talks about the Rutland sound, you know, parodying that idea of like the Mersey sound. But then the actual band, the Ruckles, are from Liverpool, played in the Cavern in Liverpool. And you know, Liverpool is sort of in it throughout. And at that point, the joke for me kind of falls down, because I think, well, but you just mean the Beatles then.
Yeah.
Like, why didn't you, you know, have a venue called, I don't know, the Tavern or whatever.
I knew what you were going to go for, and right. I couldn't think of a good rhyme, and you got there straight away. So you didn't. It was pretty good off the cuff. It's already, you're a better joke writer than Eric Idle.
I think we've proved that pretty conclusively. I think he'll be quaking in his boots right now. But certainly John Cleese should be. Sorry.
Low. He was very good in Magic Christian.
He was. You're right. It's among his best work. But yeah, at that point, it's half a joke.
Yeah.
Why don't you do the whole joke?
I feel like the film is being faithful to its roots as a spin-off from this sketch show.
Yeah.
But actually, what has survived over all this time is the film and not the sketch show. Like, yeah. People don't remember that. So actually, this idea of Rutland has just kind of slipped by, and no one really cares about that now. So the joke doesn't work. And actually, in hindsight, it makes you realise there was no need to stick to that as a sort of initial premise.
Yeah, I guess it's, you know, it worked, obviously. You know, there's a big sense of, you know, it's the bloody Beatles' White Album, shut up about this.
Yeah.
Because it worked.
We're dedicating an entire hour to this. So, yeah, I mean, it ended up having some merit.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, the joke worked. But yeah, no, it's weird. And I just wonder whether at the time, I think it went down really well at the time, I think, in general, you know, because
didn't in America, I believe. So it was shown on TV in America. I think I've seen a couple of things about how in the primetime slot it came 65th, which was last.
Right.
is how I've seen that phrase several times.
Yeah.
But I think it was a big hit here in the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I want to touch on another way of saying what we've spent the last 50 minutes saying, which is including Mick Jagger and Paul Simon in this.
Yes.
Is really, really good. It's really fun watching actual celebrities, you know, actual famous people at the time being in on the joke.
Yes.
But I would say that they're not adding to the joke. You know, like this idea that, you know, Mick Jagger and Paul Simon talking about specific moments of things that happened to the Ruckles,
yeah,
which we are aware of because we've just seen the news footage of the Ruckles doing that thing,
yeah,
and Mick Jagger is talking about them having done that thing without really adding like an extra payoff to that. The joke is in seeing Mick Jagger talk about it like it was real.
Yeah, but think how satisfying that would have been in 1978.
Yes, no, and that is fair. Like, that is like, fair. Yeah,
because you know, if you think about pop star Never Stop Never Stopping.
Yeah.
In which Ringo is one of the talking heads. In fact.
Yeah.
Probably not enough to justify an entire episode of this, but it, you know, but
we'll see. We'll see the best what we get by come season six.
Yeah, right. it's the same thing. It is, and also like in there's like the hip hop spoof documentary CB4, where like rappers are talking very earnestly about this group who changed everything.
Mm.
It's the same thing, you know. Where this, oh yeah, this is the greatest group of all time, and this is how they influenced us. It's a similar satisfaction to watching like extras or something like that, right? Where you get celebrities who are like earnestly doing a thing, and they are like engaging with the thing. Now Mick Jagger in particular delivers a really good joke in it, where he's talking about he's sort of parodying the thing where in real life the Beatles, John and Paul, like wrote "I Want to Be Your Man" for them. And it's like, oh, they just went off and sat in the corner and finished it off. And Mick says, you know, like they just went to the pub and they wrote this song and they brought it back to us, and it was horrible. We ended up not recording it at all. And like there's really good. His comic timing in that is really really good. You know, that's really satisfying.
He's actually
you know?
Very charming in those scenes. I think as he talks about it, he's very sort of natural. I do agree with that. I think that Mick Jagger example is a good example of saying that where he does say something funny. But in general, I don't know. Like, I guess you know. Asking Mick Jagger what broke up the Ruttles and is saying women like Chasse La Femme, like you know, I guess that's kind of it's funny the way he delivers that.
I think with
certainty and stuff, but
yeah,
I don't know. I was expecting a little bit more of a payoff or some kind of I get the impression that it was kind of improvised, you know. And I guess I was expecting something a bit more scripted to have that payoff.
Yeah, like if it is improvised, then like. You know, him off the cuff saying "Cherche la femme" is brilliant and
brilliant,
good for him. You know?
Absolutely.
But I think also Mick Jagger in that is sort of forced to engage with the joke. So there's a joke in it about, you know, Leggy Mountbatten slash Brian Epstein. So it's a gay joke. And so Mick is kind of forced, no, not forced to, I'm sure he did it quite willingly at the time, but like, you know, he engages with that joke. About so you see an interview with his mother who talks about well what was it that you know that you know first struck him about the band? It's like well the trousers you know Queenie, they're very tight trousers you know and all that kind of stuff you know and she delivers it really well but
it's really funny actually I think it's
really well delivered
but
also it's this is the funny thing about it's not terribly surprising for 1978 of course. But this is the thing about, you know, all the Beatles generally being okay with the whole thing. But then, you know, there are still essentially gay jokes about Brian in there.
Yeah.
But also, you know, it's not mega surprising. I mean, the Beatles themselves were making gay jokes about Brian while he was alive.
And for 1978,
yeah.
I would go so far in my capacity as spokesperson for the gay community,
really,
I would go so far as to say that potentially not as offensive as other things that were being made at that time.
Yes,
like I'm sure there are true. Relatively, relatively innocent jokes.
Yeah,
like there's this idea of Brian Epstein being interested in the boys not because of the music but because of their tight trousers.
Yeah,
is quite a tame joke to laugh at.
Yes.
As opposed to you know it's not there isn't actually a hint of seediness to that joke which would have. Made that different. It's not like there's no hint in these jokes about the Leggy Mountbatten and the Brian Epstein character that he was trying to take sexual advantage of the boys. It's just this idea that he was enamored with their tight trousers, which I took to be a sort of an innocent version of that.
That's quite innocent and quite playful.
Yeah.
But it does. I think the bit that Mick engages with later on. And repeats the bit from the narrator is about him being sort of involved in youth clubs and Boy Scouts and things like that.
Right.
And that's kind of where it's getting to.
I think it was her. I think it was Queenie that said that.
Was it?
I don't know. Maybe Mick Jagger repeated it. I could be wrong. But I can't remember. She definitely said something about that at the time, yeah.
But anyway, it's not sort of Mick Jagger that I'm blaming for this. It is the film's joke.
Yes. Yeah.
It kind of equates homosexuality with paedophilia in a very casual way, which, you know, at the time would have been an easy joke to make and probably not one that people would have paid much attention to, but, you know, has not aged terribly well.
Yeah.
But I mean, to be honest, for a comedy film from 1978, that is the absolute worst of its crimes.
And that
bit is not great at all. But in terms of when you come to look at a comedy film from 1978 in 2022, you would expect there to be much, much worse.
Yes,
in
I agree. Yeah.
Than overall, there is in the Rottles.
Yes, exactly. And as we'll no doubt and possibly have already got to in this podcast, one of the things to mention was, we mentioned previously about Saturday Night Live. So the story goes that Eric Idle, he presented Saturday Night Live at one point, and during a montage in the episode, the show aired the sketch from Rutland Weekend Television, where they covered the Ruttles, that led to Lorne Michaels' support for this film being made.
Yeah.
And as a result, we get cameos in the film. We have Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi in the film.
Yes.
All playing brilliant characters. I was really taken out of the film when they came on, though, because you expect this to be a purely British Monty Python-esque affair. Yeah. And it was very strange suddenly being like, oh my God, that's, you know, like a half of the Ghostbusters right there in this film about this Beatles mockumentary thing.
Yeah.
But they are brilliant. John Belushi's character in particular is really brilliant. Alan Klein.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's so good. Ronda Klein. And the way it's that sort of stormtrooper music.
Yes.
And he's like there in like a white polo neck jumper and sunglasses. Yeah. Got two guys behind him who are wearing the same clothes, you know. And he walks into the office and everyone's terrified of him, and one guy's hanged himself rather than have a meeting with him.
It's like, as he walks into the office, there's a guy in the background who's been like nailed to the wall.
Yes.
By his hands. It's really good.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I think it's funny, like, seeing those guys, because actually, like, the interesting thing, like, the Pythons sort of went transatlantic, but Eric Idle in particular is one of those guys, a bit like Ringo, actually, who's just spent most of his life in California since his heyday, and you know, and he's got a bit of a twang to his accent now as a result. But you know, and it's easy to forget that actually he is just as in with that Hollywood crowd as he is with the sort of British comedy crowd.
Yeah,
and so the idea that people like it, sort of early SNL people would have been in this film makes total sense.
Yeah,
but. But yes, I know exactly what you mean. We think of it as a British thing, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, it's got Americans in it.
Yes, yes. But also, it's worth re-emphasising that point. They were early SNL people.
Mm.
Now, they're Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, and John Belushi. But that could have been, in another year, a different SNL cast that wouldn't have made such a big impression now, watching it back. But it just so happened to coincide with three of the biggest stars that show ever had.
Yeah. It's a shame, actually, that Dan Aykroyd being in it is playing a character akin to Dick Rowe, i.e. the Decca executive who supposedly turned down the Beatles. Not entirely true, but, you know, that's how he's thought of. And it's just, it's one joke where he's being interviewed and Eric Idle, the interviewer, is setting the whole thing up. And then he says, how does it feel to be such an asshole? And he says, what? And that's the end of the whole thing. Again, it's not really a joke,
no,
particularly.
Yeah.
Do you know? It's like, and also quite, this is made for primarily American television. So I suppose like Eric Idle saying asshole in his British accent, just that always sounds weird.
Yeah, it did feel weird.
When British people say asshole rather than arsehole, you know, but even so, as a joke, I don't know, it just feels like a weird little attack on this guy.
I always feel like, as coming at this as a fan of those three guys, I was just a bit disappointed because it felt like his scene was wasted.
Yeah.
You know, like his joke was that he coughed a lot before giving a simple answer.
Right.
And then got accused of being an arsehole.
Yeah.
And I kind of wanted to see more Dan.
Yeah, yeah. Especially, I think Eric Idle spoke of Dan Aykroyd as being the one person, the one other comedian he'd met who could have been in the Pythons.
Oh, right.
I think he said that, like, you know, this guy really, you could just see his sense of humor, like he really got that, and that would have worked, you know, in the Pythons, which is interesting. And yeah, so I mean, maybe at the time they, you know, he didn't know Dan Aykroyd so well, I don't know, but yeah, no, it feels quite wasted.
It does, doesn't it?
Whereas Bill Murray playing Bill Murray the K,
yes,
which apparently is parodying a specific scene in a documentary that was made about the Beatles' first trip to America. And so that thing where they're in the back of the car listening to the radio and you hear Bill Murray the K, you know, on the radio calling himself the fifth Beatle, that is like a specific scene that's being parodied. But apparently Bill Murray just sort of improvised a lot, and there's like 10 minutes of that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than the minute and a half they showed, you know.
That's so unlike Bill Murray to go off script.
Right, yeah.
I feel like I've talked about everything that I wanted to talk about the Russells.
Yeah.
I've come around to it a little bit more. Like, through discussing this, you know, I feel like my stance on this was, I mean, it's a parody film. It doesn't really parody the thing it's trying to parody. But actually, you know, from talking about specific moments of this, there's still loads of elements in the film that were really, reminded me how much of it I actually found really funny.
Yeah.
I'm still not convinced that they're the bits with the Ruttles in them, but but there was still plenty of stuff throughout the film that made me laugh a lot.
No, I agree. I mean, like, I really enjoy watching it, and like I said, it's probably the third or fourth time I've seen it, and I always enjoy it, but I always end up thinking, it's just doing the thing rather than parodying the thing. But I'm not sure that is the fault of the film itself. I think it's perhaps more the fault of the fact that we expect more from satire these days. We expect it to have not a target necessarily, but a commentary on the thing that it is parodying.
Yeah.
And actually, there are lots and lots of things in the Ruttles, especially in the songs in and of themselves, as I say, but also in the film itself, that where I think it is enough that it is just doing an effective pastiche of the thing it's talking about, because it is fun and it is satisfying. But yeah, I think that there are places where it lacks jokes, but maybe that's just because it's 2022 and it's 44 years later and we kind of expect more, you know. Maybe that's all it is.
Maybe that's all it is. Tell us. Let us know. If you've seen The Ruttles and would like to tell us where we are wrong, have we slayed the sacred cow? Also, have we used the word parody enough in this podcast? I'd be interested if anyone wants to go back and do a parody count of the whole episode. Please do that, or get in touch with us about anything else on the usual social media platforms at Beatles Films Pod. Also, feel free to leave us a review if you like this episode or any other episodes that we have recorded for the podcast. Otherwise, we'll see you again for the next episode next week. Thanks again, and bye.
Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.